Representative Bowles, that's not even spelled right.
We're going to call the Senate Rural Communities and Economic Development Committee, the Joint Committee, today. We've got a very, very packed agenda. The first hour and a half is here with 1 hour for the first part of the conversation, another hour from forestry itself. Was thinking it might be, and since we don't have everybody here, it's probably good to give introductions that go fast. So I'll let the Senate give their introductions. I'm Senator Arne Roblin, Chair of the Rural Communities in the Senate.
I'm Floyd Przanski, Senator out of District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties.
And I'll turn it over to my other chair, Representative Clem.
Okay, then I'll open the House Rural Communities Interim Committee. I'm Brian Clem. I represent Salem here in the kind of center of Salem, District 21.
Mm-hmm. And I'm Katty McHugh, and I represent House District 9 over on the South Coast, Coos Fadie Yahats.
Representative John Davis.
Representative Paul Holby from District 8, South Eugene and South Central Wayne County.
I'm Denise Bowles. I represent House District 19, portions of Salem, Almsville, and Turner.
And with that, we're going to try to keep people on track today because we've got a lot of business here. And then at 9:30, the Senate is going to move down to Hearing Room B. So with that, I'll call up Vince Porter, and we're going to be having a conversation about the Executive Order 1216 report. I'm excited about hearing about this, and I'll let Vince, I'll let you kind of manage it and hold you totally responsible for the time. So it's
we'll
good. You have 55 minutes. That's good.
Stay on time. And I'll stay up here and kick anyone under the table if
okay.
Thank you.
And Clem wanted to save a half hour for questions.
And so
that's his questions, right?
Yeah, that's his questions.
Okay, Chair Roblin, Chair Clem, and members of the committee. My name is Vince Porter, and I'm Governor Kitzhaber's policy advisor on jobs and the economy. At the end of 2012, Governor Kitzhaber issued an executive order with the purpose of promoting wood products and commerce as a green building material and to encourage innovation in wood products. In short, the executive order included five items that were designed to dive into the issues and opportunities surrounding Oregon's wood products. Over time, this executive order actually expanded to include a broader scope encompassing other aspects of rural economic development, namely opportunities in agriculture. Today, we'd like to have some of the people who've worked on implementing the executive order report on some of the highlights in our findings and lay out next steps as we look to take advantage of both near and long-term opportunities in both the wood products and agriculture industry. In the 5 months that I've been working with this group, one thing's become clear to me. The opportunity to act and improve our rural economies is now, and we can do this while also benefiting our entire state. There is a global interest in rethinking how we manage our natural resources, resource economies, whether it's building 30-story wood buildings, wood frame skyscrapers, or feeding the world with our crops and added value products. Oregon is positioned to be a leader if we choose to lead. It's important to note, though, that we're not the only player in this field, and failure to act will allow other states and abroad fill the void. In recent months, multiple programs have been announced by the USDA to further advance the opportunities, and others are around the country already responding. Just last week, Clemson University announced the formation of a new institute designed to create new markets for wood-based construction materials. We think it's important for Oregon to not fall behind. But instead use our comparative advantages, leverage opportunities, and lead. The good news is that our private sector is recognizing the opportunity already. In the past 2 months, two wood-framed office buildings have been announced in Portland with leading developers Girding Edlin and Ben Kaiser. And as you will hear today, our public sector, including our universities, are also poised to lead. I know there are many groups that have followed the progress of this executive order, and some of the issues have sparked some interesting debate. The purpose of this executive order, though, was not to tilt one building material above another. The reports are also not recommending big farming over small farming or any particular crop over another. The executive order was about pursuing innovation opportunities in our natural resource economies, for its innovation that will lead us to prosperity. And importantly, the next steps are not about what one entity can do by itself, but what we can do collectively, either through administrative action, budgetary efforts during the upcoming legislative session, or other efforts within and outside the Capitol. Lastly, Before I let the rest of the group speak, I'd like to acknowledge that today's hearing and the reports we'll be taking in are a subset and a summary of the work that's been done on this issues. The report themselves provide more details than we have time to cover today. We think there's quite a bit of a commonality and overlap, and we do not want to represent that any one report is more or less important than the other. What we're most interested in is determining specific actions that we can take and would also give us the outcome we all want, a more robust rural Oregon. I'd also like to acknowledge Jeremy Rogers from the Oregon Business Council, who's also been a great partner for us over the past several months.
Thank you, Vince. Chair Clem, Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity. I'll be very brief. You get to the meat of this. I'm Jeremy Rogers, the Vice President of the Oregon Business Council. I manage the Oregon Business Plan, which is a collaborative effort with several business organizations and business leaders across the state, including OBC, AOI, and OBA. Last year at our annual summit, we announced as one of our top three priorities the restoration of Oregon's rural economies with a particular focus on natural resources. And we've, over the last year, been involved in many of the efforts that you'll hear about today, as well as just finished up a series of 12 meetings around the state with Business Oregon and tours and discussions of opportunities. And really just what I want to leave you with today is a couple of things. One is the continued commitment of OBC, of the other statewide business groups and the business plan towards natural resource industries and the revitalization of our rural economies. And also, from the experience we had this summer, it is quite clear that in every part of the state, there's significant opportunity to add value to our natural resource industries, to grow our value-added food production, to expand our markets for our wood products, as well as address some of the policy issues that you might not be hearing about in this segment, but later, related to supply. And those are going to continue to be a prime focus for us, and they are a key opportunity, I think, to bridge the urban and rural divide. Some of the things you heard Vince talk about with wood and buildings, the opportunity of food, something that unites urban and rural Oregon. I think these are unique opportunities for Oregon, primed for growth right now. And the things that you're going to hear about today are things that we support, and as Vince mentioned, there's a lot of other efforts going on, and we'll continue to work with those. We'll come forward at our summit this year with what we hope to be a robust set of ideas to move these issues forward, and we'll continue to work on them. It's not... As the economy recovers, we intend to focus on forest, on food, on rural Oregon until we get to a place where we see the kind of revitalization and reduction of poverty and opportunity in our rural communities that we know is available and that we've seen on the ground as opportunity from our experience this summer. So just want to leave you with that as you open up and hear from the rest of the panelists today. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think the first two people we'd like to have come up is Thomas Manis from Oregon State University and Tom Insko from Boise Cascade.
That'd be great.
We have some handouts I'd like to distribute that describe our partnership with University of Oregon and advanced wood products manufacturing and design.
Be sure in advance. Give your name at the beginning. Okay.
Thank you. Chair Roblin, Chair Clem, and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to come and speak with you today. My name is Thomas Manis, and I serve as the Dean of the College of Forestry at Oregon State University. And there are really a lot of things I would like to talk about with this initiative, but I've got 5 minutes, so I'm going to get right to the point, and I want to leave you with three main messages. And Vince, if I get you to flip the slide, these are my three main messages, and I'm going to show you some pictures. First message is that Western Oregon is the best place in the world globally to grow high-value trees. World population is now 7 billion. We're moving to 9 billion over the next 25 years. And in Global demand for timber has been steadily increasing over the decades, and it will continue to increase. And as architects and engineers move more towards wood building, it's going to increase faster than it has in the past. So we try to build sustainable building materials. Most of the world's wood is now coming from plantations, and there's just a few countries where these plantations are being managed, like Brazil, Chile, New Zealand, Australia, China, Russia, and Canada. If you look at all of those plantations, Western Oregon is the only place in the world where we grow native species and native ecosystems as plantations. The only place in the world. Everywhere else, you're growing exotic species and exotic plantations, completely changing the natural ecosystem. And this is having an impact. It's the only place in the world where the natural inputs for growing trees are plentiful. Everywhere else, you're starting to see pressures from not enough water and not enough resources and fertility. And our species are much higher value than the species grown in plantations anywhere else in the world. So if you really look at it from a global perspective, you look outside of Oregon, Western Oregon is the best place in the world to grow timber to meet the needs on a commercial basis, our global needs. And our conservation values that we have here in Oregon are the highest in the world. And we can talk about whether California or Washington might have a different, slightly different forest practices code or whatever. But if you look globally where wood is grown, our conservation values here and environmental practices are higher than anywhere else in the world. If you take a look outside of Oregon, this is really a unique place. Second message I want to leave you with, and this one is really, I think, critically important, is that how much we harvest, we have a debate about whether we should harvest more from federal lands or not. How much we harvest is less important to rural economies than how many people we employ with the wood that we do harvest. Our employment rates for the amount harvested are minuscule compared to those in Europe. It's about 20 times more people hired per cubic meter harvested in Central Europe than in Western Oregon. And that's something that we really need to address. Our supply chain is so shallow that we're sending 2 billion board feet of logs exported as raw logs from Washington, Oregon, and California every year, which could employ a lot of people. We need to work on that employment multiplier, and the way to do that is through not trying to jam more people into highly competitive state-of-the-art mills that we have, but to build a deeper supply chain through producing value-added products and creating secondary manufacturing. That is really something that we can do, something that other parts of the world have done. And the third message I want to leave you with is that we really are positioned to compete in the global markets for green buildings. Architects and engineers have looked at what the demand for buildings is going to be globally, not just in Oregon, but globally, and realize that we cannot build these buildings out of concrete and steel alone. Sure, there's going to be a lot of concrete and steel buildings built, but 12% of carbon dioxide emissions worldwide are due to concrete. Concrete is the second most used material on Earth. Water is the most used material. Concrete's the second most used material. To produce concrete, you take carbon out of the earth and you put it in the atmosphere. To produce timber, you take carbon out of the atmosphere and you put it into buildings. And architects and engineers have realized that. They've done their life cycle analysis, and wood is the most exciting new material to build with. And globally, it's taken off. We're seeing state-of-the-art buildings built in London, and Melbourne, and Canada. There's a new one proposed for Chicago. And this is setting a trend, a worldwide trend for building tall buildings. And this is a market where wood has never competed before in the greater than 5-story. 5 to 12-story market is huge. And above that is really possible for us. Right now we're building 10-story buildings, which is still only 1/3 the height of the tallest tree in Oregon. A tree is 3 times taller than the tallest building we've ever built out of a tree. So we know that wood is an incredible structural material. And we really have an opportunity in Oregon that we could lose if we don't choose to take it And when we can export logs to a neighboring state that does take advantage of this opportunity, we can stay very resource dependent instead of going to more high technology. I just want to show you a few pictures, and Vince, if I get you to... This is the new material that was invented in Austria. Austria is now the world leader in the production of cross-laminated timber. Most of the tall buildings in the world are built out of cross-laminated timber originating from Austria. Why Austria? They don't have the wood supply. They're not globally positioned on a port to send this stuff out. The reason is technology, innovation, and research. They invented it, and they perfected it. The next slide will show you a CLT panel that's 14 inches thick, incredibly strong. It's like plywood, but made out of lumber. The lamels are cross-laminated to give it strength in both directions. You cut the doors and windows out in the factory, you prepare it, and the advantage to building with this is how fast it goes up and how efficient it is to build a building. It's lightweight. In an earthquake, you don't have a heavy pendulum moving. You have a very light, flexible structure moving. The next slide just shows you the difference between glue laminated timber, which Oregon was a developer, early leader, and innovator in, is used everywhere now, and cross-laminated timber. You're basically building tall buildings modular in the factory. Why is that great? It employs people in the rural locations where you need this employment. The next slide shows you Bridgeport House in London, England, was the tallest wood building in the world until Melbourne topped it, and then in British Columbia, the Wood Innovation Center in Prince George topped that one. There's a race to see who can build the tallest wood building in the world right now. This was built in summer 2011, 10 weeks construction time, and that's the advantage for construction companies. It's fast, it's not messy, it's not noisy, it's really a good way to build, and it sequesters carbon. And there's a lot of research that's starting to show that living and working in buildings built of natural materials is healthier. And so companies are starting to look at building their headquarters buildings out of wood as a competitive advantage to get good people, to hire good people and get the best people into their company and to move to their communities. The next slide just shows you some of the unique design advantages. Some of the stuff that you're seeing here are Oregon products. We're really innovators. And this is... Oregon's value to the world is not low-quality wood fiber. We can't compete with Brazil. No one can. That's not our thing. Our thing is high-quality wood products, and that's what we're talking about. You look at that, that's Douglas fir used in a beautiful situation, and architects and engineers love it. This just shows you some of the unique design features of wood, and it's because I'd like you to realize that it's not just structural materials that we're talking about. As you move towards wood building, everything comes along with it. Windows, doors, flooring, ceilings. You want to showcase and use a lot of wood, which is a healthy material that doesn't off-gas like plastic and concrete and carpeting and stuff that we use. And then this picture shows you what was just a few months ago the tallest building in the world in Melbourne, Austria. Completed in 2012, 10-story wood building. That was just topped by the building in Prince George, British Columbia. And a lot of these buildings are being built in challenging sites where, you know, to build a tall building out of concrete and steel, you have to have a very extensive foundation in the ground. And some places don't allow you to do that. And wood is a perfect material to build where you don't want to have a lot of disturbance in the ground. So that's really fast. I'd love to come and talk a lot longer about these things, but that's what's happening in the world. I think we have a real opportunity here, and I really do appreciate the chance to come and talk to you about it. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairs Clem and Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Tom Insko. I'm Inland Area Manager for Boise Cascade. I live in the rural community of La Grande, Oregon. I also serve on the Board of Forestry. I'd prefer to actually spend the next 5 or 6 minutes listening more to Dean Manis about these products. It's interesting, and it does present a significant opportunity. And there is a role for the state of Oregon and the universities to play a role in cross-laminated timber, given the engineering and technical design
complications that go with that, that institutions can help promote and work with, partnering with private industry to develop that market. I'm gonna kind of delve into probably not quite as sexy, if you can call it that, innovation. But Dean Manis mentioned the need for secondary manufacturing, and if you know anything about Boise Cascade, in particular on the inland side, is we have an integrated model, and so we have plywood plant, we have a lumber facility, we also at lumber facilities, we have a particle board plant, and so we're not only using the wood in primary products, but secondary products in plywood. There's a lot of plywood in this facility right here. You just don't see it because it's overlaid. It's a great product. Many new innovations in that area that we're developing right now. But when people think about the concept of innovation, it really can take different meanings. It can be kind of new, intriguing types of things, but I kind of think of Apple, which just announced a new iPhone platform, and quote-unquote innovation to iPhone consumers or even Apple may mean something different than Android system users. Android people would suggest that Apple is not innovative whatsoever, but what Apple does is innovates with existing technologies and brings it to market in a different way that in many ways presents a better return on investment at the end of the day. There is a reason they're as successful as they are. I'd suggest we have that opportunity, in particular in eastern and southwestern Oregon, where there's existing industry infrastructure, and through the work that the state is doing, by providing some additional influence on the federal forests, it's giving us a view of a different supply picture out there that is allowing us to think about how we invest in our facilities different. And I'll use a couple of examples of real activity on the ground in the case of Boise Cascade. We're optimistic enough in the new model and the state support, and in addition to other stakeholders, and changing the tide on our federal forests, that we just literally a week and a half ago completed a significant capital project at our Elgin Plywood and Stud Mill facility. It's a multi-phase project that will be completed in 2015. Represents over $15 million of capital investment by Boise Cascade. And at the end of the day, what it's allowing us to do is leverage existing infrastructure, so it's not new or sexy, but existing infrastructure that has huge investment already embedded there. We have the workforce there. Now we're adding capital so that we can do things differently than we ever did before. And it's hard to illustrate this if you're not an industry person, but today what we can do is bring a log up to a 2-inch top. So traditionally a saw log is considered about 5 or 6 inches at the top diameter. We can now bring into a 2-inch top, we scan that full log, we will merchandise it, so the blocks that can go to our primary wood products facilities will end up there. The smaller diameter or lower quality wood will go to a chipper, and we've developed markets that we can sell that chip material to as well. So what's innovative about that? Well, it's about going to market differently, and it's about treating the forest differently. Historically, what would have happened is much of that material would stay in the forest. The small diameter wood would not have come in. What we're doing is leveraging the saw log component with the biomass component, changing the economics on the ground, and then developing systems in our manufacturing facilities such that we can also more economically separate those, extract more value, because some of that saw timber would have never made it there, get more volume for our primary wood product facility, and then also help in another area where there's great demand in the paper manufacturing side by providing a lower cost whole log chip as well. When this project is finished in mid-year next year, we'll be able to process annually more than 100,000 tons of pulpwood. So what we're doing in industry is trying to develop landscape level solutions. In other words, be able to handle the biomass that we see coming off these forests in conjunction with the saw timber that we also anticipate coming off. There are other opportunities out there I'd love to delve into with our particle board plant. Today we're running at 50% capacity. We drive already 300 miles away to provide the fiber for that facility. Meanwhile, we have forests with a lot of biomass in them today. What we're starting to talk about is with this greater assurance and state engagement and pushing for federal forest management, is there a solution for an increment of that fiber to actually come directly from the forest? And the integrated biomass facility and Wallowa Resources, a twist on that model may present the opportunity there as well. So some pretty interesting things are going on relative to just a few years ago, where industry is stepping up, investing in conjunction with your support as a state. So I thank you for the leadership that the state's taking all in there.
Thank you very much.
Unless you have any questions for...
Yes. Senator Krasinski.
Dean, the description of the cross-laminated timbers versus the glue lamb, I also noticed that it looked like plywood just in larger sections and stuff. You mentioned about the seismic qualities of it. I'm assuming it's much stronger for seismic resistance in the sense of earthquakes than like a glue lamb?
Well, they're used in different applications. So a glue lamb is a beam, mm-hmm. and this is an entire structural wall element. So it would replace an entire wall. And in fact, it's so strong that you have to engineer flexibility into the connections that connect the walls together. Mm-hmm. It totally replaces the need for most of the beam work would be, usually you would have a wall that would be made of a beam, a lower beam, and then connectors between it. But this is the entire wall element. There's virtually no flex in it because of the cross-laminated materials. So you have to engineer, and that's one of the reasons why research and design and architecture is so important to this, is that it's an engineered system, building system. And these panels, I don't know if you got the scale of it, but they're like 80 feet long. So in building, you bring them to the site, lay them down on a crane, and then just lift them into place. And you have eight stories there in that one panel. Amazing. That's been manufactured in the factory. It's really a unique building system.
Hopefully the chair will have you come back so we can have this discussion.
I would love to
We will do that. And the other big issue is it's it's very, very fire resistant.
Well, you know, that's something that I think is the most misunderstood thing about wood. So you think, well, this building is going to fail because of fire. Well, the World Trade Center failed because of fire. Steel is not a good material in a fire.
Right.
And it's everything else that burns. It's not the structural elements themselves that burn. Wood has a unique property. It's designed by nature to overcome fire by charcoaling on the outside, which is then an insulating layer. And it takes a lot longer for wood to lose its strength through fire than it does for steel to lose its strength through fire, which happens, as we saw, extremely rapidly. So that's something that's really misunderstood. Now, what we need to do through research is to learn how to produce the wood panels in a way that they don't contribute to the
fire, right,
because of the smoke and the other things that could cause health damage to people that are in a building and trying to escape from it.
Any other questions? Yes.
Thank you. Dean Maness, I'm concerned about the educational side of this. I know some of the industry are concerned that as the older people are retiring, the mill managers, those that are doing grading system, we have complex grading for the logs. Do we still have a wood science degree at Oregon State? Are we preparing trained people for the future?
Yes, Senator Close, it's something that I'm really concerned about as well. We do have a wood science and engineering department, and it's the largest department of its kind in the United States, and the closest university that has a wood science and engineering department to us is Mississippi State University. That's the nearest neighbor that we have. We have a new program in renewable materials that we designed about 3 years ago. The department head, Laurie Shimlick, is in the audience today, and I was speaking with him on the drive-in. 62 students enrolled in that program. Demand far exceeds supply of the graduates from that program. And Tom and I were just talking about this a few minutes before the hearing started. These are great jobs for people in rural communities. For somebody growing up in a rural community, the chance to be a sawmill supervisor, sawmill manager in a high-tech plant is an awesome opportunity and an awesome job. But we really need to do more recruiting. We have capability for three times the students that we currently have. But we do have the capacity, and we have a very strong program here where there's 16, I think, or 17 full-time faculty in the program. And, you know, we are the world leader. Oregon State University is a world leader in producing sustainable materials and new environmentally friendly glues and things like that.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hopefully we haven't overpacked our schedule.
We'll make it happen.
Here, but we'll move on to Tom Tuckman and Paul Barnum. And I would say, you know, early we visited with Thomas at his building, and it's really impressive to see some of the science that's happening in at Oregon State. And I'd encourage everyone to do the same.
Morning, Chair Roblin, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Paul Barnum. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Forest Resources Institute. We are a state agency created in 1991 by the legislature to advance public understanding of forest products, and forest management. Tom and I are going to make up some time here. Oregon has the opportunity to lead the nation's response to the twin challenges of climate change and forest health through the innovative use of wood. Thomas has already spoke to the properties of wood: less embodied energy to manufacture, more embodied carbon than other building materials. In advancing the use of wood and creating stronger markets, the state can serve as a catalyst to help add value to manufactured wood products and provide the incentive to increase investment in public and private forests for commodity values, certainly, but also, and perhaps more importantly, for natural resource values, air and water quality, forest health and fire resiliency, benefits enjoyed by all Oregonians. So within state government, there are several agencies that are already doing some of this work, and they include Business Oregon, Department of Forestry, Department of Energy, the Oregon Wood Innovation Center at OSU, and the Oregon Forest Resources Institute. But what we do as a state pales in comparison, for instance, what the British Columbia government does for its forest sector. So we need to examine whether there is a larger role that the state can play in terms of consistent and coordinated marketing support to Oregon forest landowners, and whether they would be actually desiring that kind of help. So that's a discussion that we need to have. As Thomas already said, we're already behind, or as Vince already said, we're already behind. He mentioned the Clemson University Institute that's looking at commercialization of wood. Forest companies in Northern Europe announced plans this year to invest $3 billion to diversify their product lines and reduce the region's dependence on fossil fuels through the use of biomass for electricity, combined heat and energy plants. There are those among us who believe that we are on the threshold of what I'm calling the wood century. Oregon, with its vast natural resources, competitive advantage that Thomas was talking about, record of responsible forest stewardship, reservoir of innovation and human talent, we ought to be the first through that door. The governor has signaled his help. In your packets, there is a proclamation that the governor has made declaring October 19th through the 25th as Oregon Forest Products Week. During that week, the nationally acclaimed program Woodworks will hold its third annual Wood Solutions Fair at the Oregon Convention Center to advance architects' and engineers' understanding of the benefits of using wood and how to use it. We expect more than 400 architects and engineers to attend that conference. In response to the executive order, over the next several weeks, members of state agencies will meet, along with representatives from universities and the private sector, to collaborate on a recommendation that we would like to bring back to you on how the state can better promote and support wood so that Oregon becomes a leader of the wood century and not a bystander. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Great, Paul. My name is Vice Chair, or Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Baird, Chair here, Chair Clem, Vice Chair McEwen. My name is Tom Tuckman. I serve as the Governor's Forestry and Conservation Finance Advisor. Thank you for this opportunity to summarize our report on forest products innovation, which is item number four, was focused on item number four in the executive order. I've appeared more often before these committees to talk about federal timber supply, and while that is remains incredibly important to the governor and the forest products industry, I think sometimes we forget the other side of the equation, and I think it's really important to hear from the folks you're going to hear from today to talk about the conversion side of the business and what we can do with the timber supply that we do have, and trying not just to maintain but to grow our leadership role in the forest products industry. While forest products innovation may not require sort of the tech equivalent of a announcement every, 12 months on the next big thing, I think it might be wise to look at that approach. The industry is an old industry, it's a mature industry, but as you've heard already today, there's a lot of exciting things happening in the industry, and we can do things to try and promote that in our state. In responding to the governor's forest products executive order, we have produced a summary report that's in your packet that outlines numerous actions. It's a laundry list of actions that we may take in all sectors, the public sector, the private sector, the non-governmental sector, to try and promote forest products in this state and become a leader, not just in this region, but across the nation. I would like to highlight four points that are further developed in the report. The first is that The report provides perspectives and recommendations on what a forest products innovation strategy might look like. The intent is to provide a sense for the very real environmental and economic opportunities associated with the industry in the state. Second, something old is something new again. I just spoke of that. New uses of wood and buildings are at a tipping point, as Paul and Dean Manis noted. Increasingly, architects, engineers, and developers are recognizing the value of wood as a green building material. So after decades of disconnect between forest management, forest products, manufacturings, and issues related to climate change and other environmental issues, there's a really big opportunity to integrate these efforts in the state if we get people pulling in the right direction. Third, if we want to play in this new world of forest products innovation, we need to develop a long-term strategy now and create a foundation of support that will transcend the inevitable leadership changes across all sectors. People move on. What I think we want to create is a foundation of support that will allow new leaders to say, hey, what we did in 2014, 2015, we need to be doing in 2025 as well. Fourth, there's no one set of actions that's going to get us from here to there. An integrated approach should be considered that includes a number of items. And again, in the report, we sort of have it broken out in sections, in the following sections, and then there are a number of things that we feel actions might be taken to put that long-term strategy into place. They include business development activities. They include development of financing programs and incentives that recognize the risks associated with innovative forest products manufacturing startups. That's a really important thing to think about. Development of non-governmental and public marketing and mission programs that will build up the industry in Oregon. Establishing testing, standard, and product development mechanisms that support the forest products industry. I know Dean Manis and the Oregon State University are doing a lot of work in this area, and really something important that could help lead our efforts. Fourth, support integrated applied research programs that support the forest product sector. And finally, I don't want to forget about timber supply. It's important. We need to continue to pursue policies that allow manufacturing businesses to have access to adequate raw material supply. So the next step is to align our academic institutions, non-governmental organizations, public sector organizations. We need to include the conservation community in this discussion. It's really important to do so, so that Oregon can become a hub of innovation, not just in the primary industry, but in the secondary and tertiary forest products manufacturing. Thanks for this opportunity, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Great.
Thanks. I did fail to mention, I think also up on OLIS, there is a two-page summary of the five different executive order points, and within each order, there's a fairly robust report, and particularly the next one that I think John Tokarczyk and Link Cannon are going to come and speak about, certification of green building.
Chair Roblin, Chair Glenn, members of the committee. I'm John Tokarczyk. I'm with the Oregon Department of Forestry. I and a number of others had the opportunity to take a look at the question of whether leading green building certification systems adequately recognize the environmental the benefits of wood products grown from trees in Oregon relative to other regions.
Did he give his name?
He did.
He did. Okay.
Yeah.
I was just making sure you gave your name.
Yeah.
Thanks.
In the course of our review, we looked at a number of different things: system development, green building principles, standards across systems, leading U.S. systems and their adoption in the United States. And then we also looked at the Oregon context for that. And the upshot of all this work is essentially we found that the leading systems do not adequately recognize the benefit of wood products from trees that are grown in Oregon relative to other regions. And basically, to get there, we took a look back, and the systems that basically grew out of social environmental awareness of the 60s, energy crisis of the 70s. And a recognition that the built environment consumes a massive amount of resources, energy, materials, and a need to do a better job of that. And essentially, the first system came out of England, and then since then, there's been pretty dynamic growth across the globe, multiple systems in Europe, North America, Asia. And while there's lots of different systems, their guiding principles are all essentially the same. They all seek to use fewer resources, create a better space for people to work and live in, and then also to reduce their impact over time, waste and environmental degradation. And so despite the fact that there's a wide range of systems around the globe, they all have their own set of standards and practices for how to function. So, but they all kind of operate in the same way. So while they have a whole set of standards developed to meet the principles, and those sets of standards vary from system to system to system. And so in the United States, we basically have two leading systems. We have the Green Building Initiative, also known as Green Globes. We also have Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, also known as LEED. And the adoption of these is pretty widespread. LEED is more adopted than Green Globes. LEED was the pre-runner and was the industry standard for quite a while, but they're both are adopted to varying degrees. Both systems are adopted by the federal government, meaning the agencies have the option to pick and choose which system they want to implement when they do a project. But the systems are also adopted by states, cities, and corporations as well. Adoption is important because it dictates construction, renovation, and leasing practices. So it has a lot of influence about who participates in the building process and what materials are selected, where they come from, what type of items go into the building, and for the life of the project itself. And the one thing to point out with this as well, recognizing that each system has its own set of standards and requirements for how people participate in the markets that green building systems operate in, both of those leading systems only recognize certified forest products within their set of standards. And so Green Globes recognizes all credible forest certification systems. LEED recognizes only Forest Stewardship Council certification system. And this is an important note that you'll see in just a moment. So understanding green building certification systems and what they essentially kind of mean for Oregon forests and Oregon wood products is essentially they have the capacity to narrow markets for Oregon wood. And depending on the system that's chosen, whether it's LEED or Green Globe, the capacity to narrow those markets becomes exceedingly, can become very narrow. So for some context, Oregon has about 30 million acres of forest land, and the bulk of that's owned by the federal government and the state, that's about 60%, The next biggest chunk is the private ownership. And of that, about 4.3 million acres is certified. Certification in the state varies. So SFI, ATFS, which are credible certification systems, make up the bulk of the forest that's certified in the state. FSC is a very narrow sliver. And so how this would play out on the landscape, if you can imagine, given a hypothetical, let's say that there was a federal construction project in Chicago. Let's say the agency that's running that project chooses LEED as their green building system. In that case, only 3.2% of the wood, if they were going to seek a credit meeting the standard of the system of the wood in Oregon, would fall for that credit. 100% of the uncertified wood in the state, which is more than 85% of the forest land, is not going to be recognized within that project. The interesting caveat here is that FSC, depending on what region of the world you're in seeking that certification, the standards for FSC certification are variable. So in competing regions where Oregon competes for what is the global market, Russia, Brazil, Southeast United States, the standards for FSC certification are arguably less obstreperous as they are relative to Oregon, yet the products go to the same spot. FSC doesn't differentiate that variable nature of certification, and LEED doesn't differentiate that differential level of performance. By contrast, if the same project was going to be done, Green Globes agency goes that route. It would recognize all the certified wood in the state, but still 100% of the uncertified would not be considered. So, you know, you can kind of see at that point, based on the landscape, how we reached our conclusions, which essentially is that the leading green building rating systems don't recognize the regulatory obligations that are incumbent on Oregon forest producers through the Oregon Forest Practices Act. But not just the Forest Practices Act, but other statutes that lend themselves to it. Land use laws, worker safety standards, especially when they're compared to the fact that it's a global market that wood competes in, and they're competing with regions where there's less rigorous legal standards and voluntary standards. And arguably this creates a disadvantage for Oregon forest producers and ignores the environmental, social, and other benefits that come from wood that's grown in Oregon relative to other regions.
Mr. Chair or Mr. Chairs, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Lincoln Cannon. I'm the Director of Forest Resources and Taxation for the Oregon Forest Industries Council. You have in front of you three items that I brought along, one page of my testimony, a related op-ed piece from the Statesman Journal, the Oregonian, that just coincidentally was published Sunday by Senator Whitsitt, and a book that was produced in 2009. It's fairly old, but I think it has come of age. In other words, I think everything in there is still applicable, and there's some great examples and some good information. I'd just like to mention, before I go into this very short summary, Mr. Tokarczyk, I think, had the very unenviable task of trying to take a one-year research project by Oregon State University and collapse it into 3 minutes. It was an extensive, exhaustive study, and it is, to the credit of Oregon State, it is a voice in a national conversation about certification that was not there before, and it's a very important piece of work in this arena. I just wanted to have you understand that it's significant and it's real important. So with that, at the outset, I'd like to say how much OFIC has appreciated the governor's executive order 1216 and how appreciative we are of working with the governor, the Department of Forestry, the Business Development, and others on this project. We think it's been great, and we look forward to continuing to work very closely with the governor's office, the legislature, builders, manufacturers, developers, and others on this exciting new frontier. As Mr. Tokarczyk mentioned, there is a, well, it's a great opportunity. There are some problems or obstacles. One is, I think, the Forest Practices Act in Oregon has, as you've heard from several people, some of the most stringent standards in the world, and it's completely ignored by all certification systems. What we can do about that, we're noodling on it. But it seems unfair that that we're subject to all those restrictions yet get no credit for it. The one piece I would like to focus in on is the LEED certification piece, which is, and I've sort of enumerated all these green building certification standards in the world, BREEAM, which was the first in UK and is the biggest in Europe. There's UGBC, which LEED, which you've heard about, Green Globes, and several others. All of these programs provide credit for using wood, and all the programs except one recognize all the credible certification systems, which is to say the Sustainable Forest Initiative, the American Tree Farm System, the Forest Stewardship Council, the Canadian certification system, and PEFC, which is an international umbrella sort of recognition of certification systems. The one exception is LEED, which only acknowledges FSC as a qualifying material. LEED has been in they've been developing new standards for some years now, and I'll wrap this up. I could talk about this for a long time. But in 2014, they came out with LEED 2014, which continued this FSC preference. As a result of that, OFIC, the Oregon Small Woodland Association, Weyerhaeuser, and a number of other Southern Forestry Associations and landowners around the country filed an appeal against LEED version 4. So that is that appeal was filed a year ago. That is a discussion that is in progress. As you've heard from District Karzik, and I think the brunt of the report that was issued really shows that there's no real logic behind an FSC preference, but this is a very political discussion. And I'm not sure how much logic is playing in it at this point, and a lot of this is above my pay grade, but we are continuing those conversations with USGBC, and we hope to get some resolution. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes. Representative Holby.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I've listened to this conversation, and I am very supportive of trying to solve these issues. It's very frustrating for, I think, all of us to see our jobs being shipped overseas in raw logs. And I know this LEED standard is something I've also looked at and is very hard to understand. You know, it's certainly not the product itself that doesn't qualify, the wood. So it must be our practices that are not meeting those standards. And, you know, I hope we're doing work to force LEED to identify what those practices are so we can better align our forest practices to meet these standards, because it really is important. And the other aspect I just want to touch on shortly, or, you know, briefly, is the discussion about timber supply. And granted, we've had some challenges with our federal forest lands producing timber. And, you know, I've listened to mill owners, you know, really, you know, saying we don't have enough supply to run our mills. And yet I go down to Coos Bay, to Longview, and I look at our overall forest harvest in this state, and it's really at record levels right now. And when you look at the whole forest on private lands and public lands, and so the supply is actually there, but our industry is choosing probably for a better price or a higher price to ship those logs overseas instead of having that added value remaining here in Oregon. So that's really been frustrating me over time. And the last couple sessions, I've introduced bills to provide tax credits for logs that are milled in Oregon. And yet the industry really hasn't responded to that challenge. And so and one part of the industry is saying, oh, we need more logs, we need more logs, but there's no effort to, you know, really provide a solution to stop that export of our jobs overseas. Certainly, I think we need to identify what these issues are with LEED, because I think that really is a big issue. But we need to also align our forest practices to meet some of those roadblocks, those obstacles. And because it is frustrating that Oregon has been, and I'm a carpenter, and I love wood, and I think, you know, I've known about innovative wood structures for a long time. So it's very frustrating to sit by and watch this debate that seems to have no solution. And so I'm hopeful that we will be able to change our policies to keep those logs in Oregon, to get that added value to our economy, add jobs, and also to look at our practices to try to solve this problem with LEED and these other unfair systems. You know, we really need to make them identify why we're not meeting those standards and take them head on, you know, whether it's our practices or maybe it's a little bit of both. But I'm encouraged by this presentation. I'm encouraged by the direction that this looks like it's going, because it does mean a lot to all of us, I think.
I don't know that there's a whole lot of questions there, and I agree that we have increased the log production, but it's certainly nowhere near what it used to be. So I just want to correct that one section. We used to produce a lot more wood than we do now in the state of Oregon. But it would be, and I agree, I think this is on the right track to get moving towards there. Any other questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, can you tell me, I'm told that LEED grades partially on how the wood is harvested. And because Doug fir is most effectively harvested by clear cutting and replanting, which we're required to do, of course, under our Oregon Forest Practices Act, that there's a problem there, because that then LEED penalizes us.
Chair Rowland, Chair Clem, members of the committee, it's hard to go into detail. There's a lot of questions, and you can help me out, Link, if you have any thoughts.
Actually, I'd take a cut at it if I could. Chair Clem, Chair Rowland, Senator Close, I think I've thought about how to understand this a lot, and the way I've come to, not being an expert in it, the way I've come to understand it is FSC was a international certification system that was really designed to protect tropical forests. And in that sense, what they want to do within FSC is protect native environments, and that's why they like plantations. Plantations, as you heard, there's lots of certified plantations all over the world under FSC, because it doesn't deal with the native forest. In Oregon, as you've also heard from Dean Manis, that's what we have is our native forest, and it's a productive native forest, and we manage it that way. And SFI was a system that was created to certify, if you will, not protect indigenous forests, but to encourage sustainable management on working forests. And so they come from a basically different place. And as I've said, under every green building certification system in the world, really, they are both, and by the federal government, which accepts Green Globes or LEED, they are both accepted as credible certification systems. So to Representative Holvey's question, how can we or should we change our standards, our Forest Practices Act, to meet FSC standards? We can't, because of the structure and the way our forest lands work and our ecology here. FSC standards simply don't work here unless they're willing to recognize our practices. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Because we, in fact, on plantations, they actually clear cut. So it's not the clear cut itself. It's the fact that it's a natural forest.
And that's, excuse me, Mr. Chair, if you get into the report done by OSU, they get into some depth about the different restrictions in, for example, Brazil, which has no clear cut limitations, Russia, which has very broad clear cut limitations, and so forth. That's all in this report.
Yeah, we'll look at that. Thank you very much.
Hopefully we have another 15 minutes.
Give you 10.
If we can give them time, then we'll just split up.
We'll do it.
Yeah. Okay, yes. Great. Because I definitely want to...
You just wiped out the forestry department, but that's okay.
I definitely want to make sure that we have time for David Chen and Sam Tannehill to come and talk. Governor asked David to come and take a set of fresh eyes based on his past experience working both helping create the Oregon Innovation Council. And so I definitely want to give David some time and also Sam.
Thank you. My name is David Chen. As was mentioned previously, the founding chair of the Oregon Innovation Council and also CEO of the Equilibrium Capital Group. So in April of last year, the governor asked for Executive Order 1216 to be expanded beyond its original intent, which was very much forestry and timber focused, to broadly address the issue of our natural resource marketplaces. So there's a larger report that's available. It's been loaded up onto the site, and what I'll do this morning is try to go through three summary slides of some of the conclusions. The process that we used in this expansion of Executive Order 1216 was to address the challenges of the rural economic development and to try to come up with a set of recommendations that address the growth of our natural resource economies. So the reality is, if we're going to fix the issue of poverty and jobs in rural Oregon, it's not by implementing high tech or things like that. It's really addressing what the innovative capacity is and the evolution of our natural resource industries. The way that we did this was that over the course of about 6 months, we reached out to approximately 75 business leaders and key elected officials throughout Oregon, ran a number of roundtables all around the issues of innovative business models and ways of creating jobs in Oregon's natural resource industries, which include but are not excluded to crop production, dairy, ranching. Our fisheries, our very, very important food processing industries, of course, forestry, but now also to include renewable energy, which now takes place in our rural lands, and the emerging markets of the use of biomass in the form of biomaterials and also renewable energy. If I can go to the next, that's great. So something a little bit different than I think what's been talked about this morning, and if you'll indulge me in just a few minutes here, and that is to take it outside of Oregon and to ask the question of what's happening in the natural resource markets globally. And I would summarize it by the very first sentence, and that is that we now have the challenge of 7 billion people moving to 9 billion people in the course of a few decades with, and this is the key thing, with approximately 2 to 4 billion people that will be categorized as middle class within that populational growth globally. The reason that is so important is that is a move to consumption. I jokingly say that in the course of the next couple of decades, what we're going to be challenged with is 2 to 4 billion new people wanting to eat chicken and drive a car. All right? The minute you move into a higher income, you want to provide a better life for your family, which means a better diet, better education, and transportation, which all means consumption of natural resource. You want to live better, you want to drive better, you want to eat better. Secondly, global food companies have moved in the last few years from just chasing supply to increasingly becoming very aware of what food they're processing, where it comes from a food safety and traceability standpoint, and critically important, they're pushing value add further and further back into the supply chain, closer and closer to the farm. They want to know where it's from, they want you to do more of it, and they want to have the scale and capacity to deal with that. Third thing is we're seeing huge consolidation and scale taking place in every one of our natural resource industries globally. And there's never been a time, and I think this is an important attribute. Oftentimes when we sit and talk about the challenges of our natural resource, we also hand in hand talk about the lack of capital. Well, one of the interesting things that's taking place in the natural resource industry is that global investors, and this includes sovereign wealth funds, as well as pension investors, as well as endowments and foundations, institutional investors, people that are investing for the long term, I would say without much exaggeration, there's never been a time when those capital pools have been more interested in the natural resource industries. there's an absolute flood of capital looking for agricultural infrastructure investments, agricultural value add investments, and in fact, we've all seen and heard about the run up in land, in institutional land, being acquired or invested in the greater Midwest of the United States. So it's not an exaggeration that this is one category and a period in time when the global capital markets, investors, are most interested in this 9 billion people, this middle-class consumption, and therefore the natural resources. Rural lands are moving from single-purpose to mixed-use models, and it used to be in the good old days a forest was a forest and a wheat farm was a wheat farm. And today, almost all these are now evolving into what are now being called working landscapes. And that is that they are now becoming much more complex. The wheat farm is both an energy resource, a water resource. The stalks may be used for biomaterials, and the wheat may, in fact, stay as food. We've seen the forest turn into the same set of opportunities. What this spells between consolidation and the change of the rural lands into working landscapes and complex mixed use is the implementation of technology, the implementation of data, the implementation of energy. And one of the great implications of this is the changing jobs. And so we're moving from very manual jobs to now actually very educated, I'll call them technician jobs, where it's not uncommon now to see on a large farm a water technician, an energy technician, electrical workers, IBEW, carpenters that are there permanently building and reconstructing. So we have seen massive implications for the kinds of jobs, and if you haven't had a chance, I would just urge you to take a organized field trip out to the Hermiston, Porta Moro, Boardman, I'll call it triplex. And really not just dig into what the economic model is, but dig into how the jobs have fundamentally shifted in what we would historically term an agricultural economy. And what we'll see there is the growth of what I would call family wage jobs as a result of this move to value add, this move to mixed use, this mixed move to scale and the industrialization of our industries. Lastly, sustainable practices are no longer about save the planet and being good to just being simply good to the earth. They are now being thought of as productivity, value add, and long term. And if you ever need an indication of this, just think about what's happening in California and what is absolutely now drawing the attention of water stewardship, land stewardship, and increasingly we're going to see pressure here in Oregon as we see the northward migration of agriculture uprooted or optimized in California and then transferred into Oregon. The summation of this set of global changes and national changes that's taking place in our natural resource industry is that we have an Oregon opportunity to grow with these new market demands and to grow it, I think, in a uniquely Oregon way. I'm just going to, in the interest of time, skip through and go right to a set of recommendations, and maybe turn to page 5. As a result of these 75 or so interviews, these roundtables, the look at the global trends as well as our business leadership here in Oregon in the rural economies, I think there's a set of recommendations that we're working on. One is this idea of regional rural hub regions and the move towards hub regions. And I think it's exemplified by the Porta Moro, Boardman, and Hermiston, which in as little as 25 years has really created a multi-billion dollar economic engine. There's a need to examine the reform of land use regulations to allow for industrial functions now within a rural setting. We need to take our very first steps or major steps here in water access and potentially starting with the Umatilla-Hermiston water access on the Columbia River and therefore expanding and the economic potential of the region. As we've heard for most of the morning, the development of an Oregon commercial wood construction program. I think there's a very real opportunity and need here to develop a signature research center, again, in the next generation of natural resource sustainable practices. and take that research in our higher ed and integrate that with vocational and extension services to keep that resident within just our higher ed doesn't execute the change that we really need. And I would emphasize here, we almost always emphasize four-year degrees, and one of the major implications of the changes that are taking place in our natural resource industries is in the technician vocational training. Honest, good-paying, but technical, blue-collar and working family wage jobs. We're living in a global financial industry where we know that there's never been greater interest in these industries from a finance standpoint, and therefore from our standpoint, increasing our sophistication and being able to absorb these kinds of capital. And then the opportunity, I think, in 2015 or 2016 to actually draw a tremendous amount of attention to these natural resources here in this region with potentially outreach and branding.
Good morning. Chair Clem, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Sam Tannehill. I'm a founder and director of production at A to Z Wineworks. A to Z Wineworks started in 2002 with 2,500 cases. This year we are well on our way as we speak to making about 360,000 cases. We are also the world's first certified B Corp winery, which is pretty neat. Happened a couple months ago. I've got a few slides. I know you've got a long day ahead of you, so I'm going to be try to be very quick. This is a presentation that an idea that was really started with myself and Patrick Kreitzer from Tillamook, CEO of Tillamook, and the OBA, the OBC, and Northwest Food Processors Association, that we saw a great window to develop the food and beverage, value-added food and beverage Oregon industry to really help accelerate it. So we've been meeting regularly over the past few months and are now meeting with Dave and Vince to see how we can really accelerate this industry. So we've got couple slides. Uh-oh, we don't have the slides. So anyway, I had a couple of really neat slides to show how the Oregon Food and Beverage Manufacturing Company industry was really moving forward versus all industries during recession and across the U.S. as well. One thing that I do want to point out, that the median salary in the food and beverage industry in Oregon is $49,000 a year, which is, real middle-class jobs that are mostly the growth that we're seeing in rural Oregon. So we've got the employment trends here. If you can see down below, when the recession hit, we had a dip in all other manufacturing industries. However, the Oregon food and beverage industry just kept going up and up. On the next slide, it shows the employment trends versus Oregon in the U.S. and the food and beverage industry. We have a real opportunity to capitalize on this development here in the state of Oregon. We have really great media that's coming to the state. It seems like not a day that we don't pick up a New York Times and see a mention of Portland or Oregon in the food scene. So in light of this environment, Patrick and I sat down with a group of industry veterans and executives and form the Oregon Food and Beverage Leadership Council. People that are companies that are represented on this council are Stumptown Country Natural Beef, Dave's Killer Bread, Earth 2O, Ninkasi, Bridgetown Natural Foods, Bull Run Distillery, Harry and David, as many others. We're sort of putting the finishing touches on that list, and we'll get the final list to you soon. So after meeting, we've decided that there are a few key opportunities to get together and to work towards accelerating the industry here in Oregon. The first is creating and I think accelerating the necessary research, technical, and educational infrastructure to meet the needs of Oregon's value-added food and beverage companies and to support Oregon's brand position in food and beverage. We've had many discussions with OSU and hoping to accelerate the and perhaps renew and re-envision the food center at OSU and also a fermentation science center down at OSU. We'd also like to strengthen brand Oregon in a way that attracts the most talented food companies and beverage professionals here into Oregon and establishing Oregon as a place to be for food innovation. We're seeing, as Dave mentioned, we're seeing a lot of investment in the food and beverage industry, and actually a lot of that investment is now headed down to California as opposed to coming here to the state. We'd also like to develop Oregon's consumer brand equity that can be leveraged by Oregon's individual food and beverage companies. When I say this, we're looking not at a program to influence consumers, but perhaps influence the distribution chain and the people in our industry that we would call the tastemakers and the gatekeepers across the United States. We want to make it easier for existing and prospective new Oregon food and beverage companies to do business in Oregon, notably in the area of adding new processing capacity and critical components of the required food and beverage infrastructure. I think that's something that's really important that we had a lot of discussion on. For instance, my company now sends grapes up to Washington to be processed into wine, then brought back into Oregon to be bottled because it's half the price of what we can find to do it here in Oregon. Country Natural Beef sends cows to be processed up into Washington because they don't have the infrastructure to meet their needs here in Oregon. We want to make sure that we keep those jobs here in Oregon and develop that infrastructure. We also need to better organize and coordinate Oregon food and beverage sectors and companies' efforts to develop export markets, specifically in Asia. We've got great close proximity to Asia. We should really be coordinating across the food and beverage sector of how we can move the industry forward in those areas. We also feel that there's tremendous opportunity not only in export markets but here in the United States as well. Oregon is well known in New York, as I mentioned before, in Chicago, but you go to Indianapolis or Denver, and there's a lot of work we could do here. As our industry would say, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit that we can that we're able to achieve. I think lastly, and it's not listed here, is that the companies that we were discussing in our group that we were discussing with are really interested in creating a certified Oregon system. And this certified Oregon system, I think that our council perhaps would rather support rather than try to come up with a system. We've been in discussions with Sustainable Northwest of how this could be achieved, but something that is rooted here in Oregon, that Oregon companies can put on their packaging that represents not only their companies but the state of Oregon itself. Oregon is in has a tremendous opportunity to move forward in the food and beverage industry. We already have great inertia. We just need to figure out how to accelerate that and how to make sure that Oregon comes out on the top. There's a lot of states that are fighting for this leadership position in the United States right now, and we certainly want to be there. Oregon's got a very rich, very long agricultural tradition, agricultural heritage, and a great food and beverage processing, value-added processing industry as well. We want to make sure we capitalize on that, and we feel that the window is we have a short window to do that in. So we've got some very specific proposals that you all will see soon. We want to make sure that we have buy-in from all of our individual members as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. I know that was a lot of time. And
it's okay. Forestry will only hold it against you.
Okay. That's good. Just so you know, our next work is we're developing both an ag and a forest work group so that we can implement some of these principles and ideas into the governor's recommended budget, and would be excited to work with all of you so we can move some of these things forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We are going to, so people know, take a short recess from the Senate committee as we move to Hearing Room B, and we will have the forest health, forest fire season update, and mining regulations going down in Hearing Room B in about 5 minutes. So we're going to take a recess while we move buildings.
Musical chairs.
We're out of time.
We are going to reconvene the House Interim Committee on Rural Communities, and we've got a couple members who are still with the other group listening to our other presentation about forestry. They'll probably walk back in the middle of your presentation, so excuse them. They happen to represent areas that have a lot of timber in their area, and so they really wanted to hear this next topic. But for the rest of us, and we'll have a few members coming back in just a second, we get to hear about something very exciting, which Representative Gilliam and I got a preview of last May-ish and met some students that are very, very exciting to hear about what they're working on. And we're going to get a chance to hear about them and then go see a tour after that of a I wouldn't call it a similar program because they are a lot more than just a garden, but we are going to go see a garden after that here locally in Salem. So let's get started so we can stay on time because I know you've been practicing schedule, etc. So please join me, Rick and Kelly. Oh, there's Kelly.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Clem and member of the committee. For the record, my name is Rick Sherman, Oregon Department of Education Farm to School and School Garden Coordinator. And I have a special guest with me today, too, I'd like to introduce. It's kind of her debut. She started last week for the Department of Agriculture, my new counterpart. And
Thank you, Chair Clem and member of the committee. My name's Amy Gilroy. I'm the new Farm to School manager, and this is my second week. And so I just wanted to say I'm excited to be here and looking forward to this great work.
Okay. So a very brief background of why we're here today. The newly completed USDA census shows that Oregon schools spend $9.5 million on local food in Oregon, which equates to 24% of their total food budget being spent on local. This is the highest percentage in the country spent on local food in the nation for the people in the states that have responded to the USDA census. So no doubt helping this cause is the grant I manage with Representative Clem sponsored, House Bill 2649, which enables us to spend to reimburse $1.2 million to Oregon school students for 15 cents per meal for purchasing Oregon grown or processed food. So there's that, and then the other thing about this is the part of my job that I manage is school gardens. Currently, Oregon has 516 school gardens, and for a visual, I brought some of these. You want to hand that over to the lady there? So 516 school gardens. Oregon is the only state in the country that knows exactly how many school gardens we have, and we have a contact for each one of them. So we're really excited about that. When I was building this process of the, we were hovering at 499 for quite a while. And when we got to 500, it just happened to be that it fell on Malala High School. And so I was introduced to Kelly, and I just happened to casually mention to her that she was going to have the 500th school garden. And she pretty much went nuts and decided to have a big, giant celebration of that. And we took a picture of that, and the picture went on the banner of the Oregon Department of Education website, where Representatives Clem and Gilliam saw that. They said, we wanted to come out and see this wonderful program in action. When we did that, Kelly had a captive audience, and she was able to speak to these gentlemen for quite a long time, and where they finally stopped her after about an hour and said, okay, we need to have you come back and speak at the Rural Communities Committee and bring your students with you. And so that's where we are today. The other thing is I was able to nominate Kelly for the OPHI Health Genius Award, which it's an award they give one individual award a year. And she won that, and I was able to give her that award last Friday at the Multnomah Athletic Club to multiple standing ovations for about 400 attendees. It was just fabulous and wonderful for Oregon School Gardens. So, Kelly.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kelly Douglas. I am Russian Orthodox Old Believer, and I am the advisor to a club called Culture Club. We're a 4-H Yay club, which means Youth Advocates for Health. And we started our garden in Malala Courtyard on May 22nd. And we built the garden in one day. And our club consists of, I see you go, really?
It's big, too.
It's great. Russians, we did a good job. and so we built it in one day, and we served a vegan meal, homemade meal, to about 70 people, including the kids.
You grew it all in that same day?
We didn't grow it that day, but we did cook it.
You guys are amazing.
We did cook it. Yeah, wow. There's our 4-H, since we are a 4-H team. One of the great things about our club, I've been at Malala High School for 17 years, and this club has really been able to bring everybody together through gardening. Over the summertime, we worked 2 days a week in the garden. The kids knew what days, when to come, and we worked really hard working in the garden. We had water fights afterwards, and then all the kids got to take home fresh produce that they grew to their homes to help these really low-income rural families to get some fresh produce into their hands. The extra produce that we had over the summer, we donated to Meals on Wheels, which was really appreciated from the older people in our community. Right now, this Monday, we're kicking off a micro-enterprise business plan where our students are making fresh hummus and selling it after school with a plate of veggies and a whole wheat pita for $1.50. There's no live food on campus, and these kids are hungry. They're growing teenagers. They need some fuel before practices and games. And so with the micro-enterprise business plan, it's giving our Culture Club members the opportunity to get some very valuable employment skills. They're learning customer service, supply and demand, and money handling, which is really going to help them out quite a bit. And the money is going to be reinvested each year into fresh soil, fresh nutrients, and seeds. And we really are making a difference on our campus, and you're going to hear from some amazing teenagers. The club is 100% ran, maintained by teenagers, and these kids are really making a difference in the fight against childhood obesity, and that's why we're here today, to promote funding for school gardens. Thank you.
Okay.
Wake up.
Kids.
Come on.
We have some kids.
Yeah. So I think I've got Jackie, Alicia, Angela, and Evlalia. No, Evlalia.
Evlalia.
I wrote it out phonetically too, and I still screwed it up.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jackie Gonzalez, and I am the president of Culture Club this year. I've been with Culture Club since day one, so that was last year when they only had 8 Russians. I've always loved the culture Russians. I've always liked how they dress and everything. Well, one day they were in the meeting, and I wanted to be in this club. Well, I come up with the idea that Russian with this club should also be with different cultures, so we can all come together and work together. Because in our school, you only see cultures all different. You don't see cultures combined, and that's now by this club, you see all cultures combined, and that's the beauty of this club, because you don't see that in the school. You see all these teenagers separated and all that. Well, Culture Club has helped me also communicate with other members of the school and have helped me communicate with other students that I didn't know they were part of our school. Well, I am also really thankful that this garden has helped us change a lot. I've been working with kids, with a lot of students from our school, and I've been getting closer to them. The fact that we eat healthy every day, and I tasted ground cherry, something that I've never tasted. Well, I didn't really like them. They're not my thing, but they're still pretty good. But yeah, so now I'm going to pass the microphone to Angela.
Thank you, Chairman Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Angela Shvachka. This is my second year as a Culture Club co-event planner. I believe our cultural gardening club is making a difference on campus, and I would like to tell you why. I'd like to start off by saying that I'm very proud of being a part of a club where teenagers are teaching teenagers sustainability. As a Ukrainian-American, it is important for me to share my culture with others, and I believe that gardening is the best way to do it. We, the modern technology youth of today, are putting our hands back into the soil, reconnecting again with Mother Nature, honoring your forefathers, and restoring the forgotten art of gardening. I would like to encourage you to fund school gardens because of the impact they can have on any person's or student's life. And we're an extremely successful club for several reasons. First of all, we are bridging the cultural divide, one tomato at a time. We're a technology-free club, so we spend so much time in the garden that we have neither the desire nor the time to get onto our cell phones. Everyone wants to be at the meetings and events because they revolve around culture and gardening. This is a club for all types of students because differences are truly celebrated. And finally, our garden is a living legacy to Malala High School, working towards helping fight childhood obesity. This is something that we can pass on to the younger generation, continuing the cycle of sustainability. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Elisa Cortez. I'm Hispanic, and I'm the co-vice president of Culture Club. Being a senior at Malala High School has given me the opportunity to see change throughout the 4 years. My freshman and sophomore year, I was kind of the one stirring up trouble and, you know, just involved in everything. And there actually used to be a lot of fights at our school, and I noticed since last year, since the club started, they actually have gone down. And I've seen people that didn't necessarily get along actually getting along now and working together outside in the garden. I have a quote from the Dean of Students, Ms. Sip. She said, "When profiled, most of the students involved in Culture Club are high risk. However, within the high risk label lies a highly motivated and leadership bound. What Culture Club students have achieved in the last year is the power to define their choices in education." We have our principal, Mr. Dalton, here to lend credibility to our testimony. And thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Evlalia Turan, and I am Russian Orthodox Old Believer. We have found a way to incorporate intergenerational community bonding throughout our club and our garden because we invite the older generation, our grandparents' generation, to come back when they can't garden anymore with themselves. We have waist-high garden beds to allow them to garden with us. Also, we are inviting the elementary school children to come to learn from us to repeat the cycle of sustainability. We are helping fight childhood obesity because each student walks. We have students come in our garden with a bag, and they pick fresh fruits and vegetables, and they go and they share with their friends. You see kids walking around with a bag of vegetables, and they reach in like it's Halloween candy. Instead of processed sugar, it's fresh, organic vegetables. And I don't think you've ever seen that in high school before. Over the summer, we donated 100 pounds to Meals on Wheels, and we continue to help low-income families get the fresh vegetables that they couldn't otherwise have. Thank you.
So tell me, I know more about this than the other members, and there's some things that because of time you didn't get to focus on, but we've got a couple extra minutes. So tell the rest of us how many members of the club there are.
158
members. And this is a high school of about?
A little over 700.
700.
I started with three.
So it's like a quarter of the high school is in this club. That's how, 4 years old?
This club?
It
started last year, and the garden started in the middle of the year, but the actual club started out with just 8 Russians in September.
Yeah. And beyond the garden now, remind me of some of the other things that you do. It seems like there's a movie night. There's a variety of other things that you do besides just the garden, which is awesome in and of itself.
Thank you, Chairman Clem, members of the committee. So we have a monthly cultural dinner where, for example, the first time we had a Russian dinner and where the Russians cooked, and then we watched Finding Nemo in Russian. And then the second time we did a Hispanic dinner, and we played musical chairs to mariachi music. So another thing we did was we raised over, how much was it for the, no, well, we raised a lot of money for to buy a coffin for a family that couldn't afford it. Mm. And it was just in 3 days. Mm. So
this club is really just bringing together people that otherwise would not be together. We embrace differences that otherwise people would look down upon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was struck by, while we were there, we stopped and had lunch in the lunchroom, and you could sort of make out little pods, like maybe there's the jocks over here, but for the most part, you couldn't tell anymore. Mm-hmm. Everybody was doing their Culture Club sign, including the people who all had their game jerseys on, and it was really quite extraordinary. You know, it's been a while since I've been in high school, but there was nothing that approached that level of acceptance, I think, in such a quick time, and embracing it. And it's just phenomenal. And I swear, I did not put this on for today. This has been on me since that day. And my staff person, Beth, she's like, "Oh, good, you already have your thing on." I said, "Oh, I never took it off. It's been on there the whole time." So any questions for this young group of students? Representative Davis.
I have a question maybe for Kelly.
how has this, to me it looks like you've done a lot of work. Has the state been helpful, or has the bill that has been passed, or has been there been support for you in this program?
Yeah, yep, please come out.
Will you change spots? Yep. Thank you so much. Thank you for the question. Because we're rural and we're low income and we're kind of unique and dynamic, we were able to apply for a grant through OSU, and we received a $5,000 grant, which was very beneficial to help us in the garden. Mm-hmm. We also received a $70,000 farm to school grant for Sodexo. Our cafeteria received that to receive fresh local food. They donated $1,000 to us, and that helped us with wheelbarrows. And one of the things that we're struggling with right now is shoes. We're a very low-income community. Not a lot of parents have the ability to buy an extra pair of shoes. When I say let's garden, some of the kids will look at their nice shoes and say, okay, Mrs. Douglas, I'll help. But that's their only nice pair of shoes. So we are looking for more funding for boots, for rain gear, and such like that. We just applied for a grant for $2,500 through the Clackamas County Small Grant Program for a refrigerator so that we can keep our hummus and fresh produce. And my principal just gave us permission to apply for another $2,000 grant through Whole Foods, and so that we can get a compost bin built. And we also need a three-part sink outside so we can wash our fresh vegetables. So we do have support, but I think my struggle, because all of those grants are so specific for what you can spend the money on. And what was really, really wonderful is we've had a few donations here and there, and that's allowed us to get a few extra things. But, you know, our monthly dinners are expensive, and the money comes in very handy for us to be able to get 150 people together, and the kids cook themselves. The kids bake the bread. The kids serve. The kids clean up together. Everything is bonded and around vegan food. We invite you to please come and see us.
Well, if you wouldn't mind smiling, can I take a picture of all of you? And everybody else in the audience has to smile too, not just the kids. Kelly. Thank you.
Yes, I'm supposed to say farm to school.
Malala received a $70,000 grant through the farm to school.
Farm to school grant for Sodexo. That's what they donated the $1,000 to us for, is farm to school. Yes.
So I want to acknowledge a couple other people that are here. I'm not going to have you all come up, but they mentioned Mr. Randy Dalton, who's the principal of the school. Yes. Who's here to visit, our helpful information provider, Bray Halverson, who just, or is it Barrett?
Brett.
Who just gave us some information. Benito Ortiz, who is our co-vice president. Yomaira Tarula, is that close on the pronunciation? Maria
Palacios.
Alyssa Rosenau. Lily Mendoza, Noah Klein, and Leanna Thompson, who are all members of the club, and they're all here today as well.
Thank you.
And then Peter Truitt, who's going to join us, I think, for our next portion at Parrish as well, the owner of Truitt Family Foods. And I think that's it on my whole list of people to acknowledge. If I miss you, I apologize. The other piece of business I have, I will do after we recess here in a second, which was I owe these young people $500 that I promised them, and I have
to
check.
Did you get the wink? I was shooting.
Representative Gilliam already paid his part, and mine's like 3 months overdue.
There's a little interest involved there.
Yeah.
Oh. I like it.
Oops.
Yeah, that was 120%.
I'll pay that out of
my 120% interest from that date.
On that day. All right. I'll pay that out of my pocket.
$773 now.
Okay. So great. Thank you all for coming down so much. I hope that some committee members can make it to one of your nights, because it's different. For you, it's exciting to be here. For us, it's more exciting to be there, to be honest.
Yeah.
Oh, great. So let me excuse you and have Peter come up. And Michelle, come on up. I really should have sped that up then. Great. Welcome.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peter Truitt, president of Truitt Family Foods, and with me is Rod Friesen, director of sales and marketing, and Michelle Radcliffe, PhD, Director of Market Development, Farm to Table Initiatives at Truett Family Food. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. Truett Family Foods is a spinoff from Truett Brothers Incorporated, a fixture in Salem for the last 41 years. Truett Family Foods employs about 60 people, varying with seasonality. Our most recent employee, Michelle Radcliffe, joined our team 4 weeks ago. She is a nationally recognized farm-to-school and school-garden expert and illustrate Truett Family Foods' commitment to the farm-to-school initiative begun by the Oregon State Legislature regarding K-12 throughout the state. On two previous occasions since 2007, I provided the Oregon State Legislature with data on how Oregon school purchases meaningfully impacted Truett Brothers' employment and tonnage actually purchased from Oregon growers. Today I share with you the good news that the support of the Oregon State Legislature's farm school initiatives coupled with Biz Oregon's grant helped influence a new business model at Truett Family Foods. The school food market in Oregon and elsewhere has concentrated on healthy alternatives. The overriding direction of K-12 and farm to school has especially emphasized increased consumption of a variety of fruits and vegetables. We sought to develop a line meant to provide these markets with products that make consumption of the correct foods appetizing to kids and others. State funding of farm-to-school activities carved a new and better pathway of sourcing for schools. Then in late fall 2013, Biz Oregon helped Truett Family Foods win a grant from the Governor's Strategic Reserve Fund based on the shelf-stable hummus product we intended to pack. Since then, that concept has led to a broader line of products for K-12 and other non-commercial customers around the country. It turns out that many other segments, including preschools, healthcare, colleges, universities, and retail outlets, care about healthy alternatives too. The products we develop for the K-12 market provide a firm foundation for these and other broader markets, all of which are obsessed with healthier alternatives. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today and for the legislature's attention and commitment to farm school activities. Rod, Michelle, and I are happy to answer any questions you have.
Well, one thing I might comment on, the state, while it's somehow managed to get some money out of itself to help, has really, in the end, not done nearly as much as we need to or want to. But this idea in and of itself and the buy-in from private sector partners and community members and schools has somehow led us into the highest proportion of local foods being used in the school in the whole United States. And yet, in the end, we've only kicked in a couple $1 million, whereas we really need to be up to like $20 million to have schools do it. When I first met Peter, we talked about their business in schools in other states. And they're one of the largest employers in Salem. And I said, boy, why don't we do it here? And he said, because they're not the best customers. They don't have money to procure a decent product. And so they end up just going low bid. And, you know, we're not interested in and able to compete with some of these imports that would fit that kind of criteria. But that's what our schools are forced to do, is just get the cheapest thing they humanly can, regardless of nutritional quality. And that was heartbreaking to know that one of the biggest employers in town can't even find it profitable to sell to our own schools, but yet they can take it all the way to Georgia and sell. So to see that that's turning around and we're starting to see improvement is very heartwarming for me after spending, you know, 6 years or 7 years along with Michelle and others from the beginning on this. But we could amplify the economic benefits and the childhood health benefits and the environmental benefits 20-fold easily with an appropriation that's larger. So I'm going to have to re-challenge all of my colleagues that sit in kind of the economic development related committees to examine what's happened here in terms of return on investment compared to other programs that are already funded. And because this was new at one time, we could never break into being compared apples to apples with other programs. because $20 million is a lot of money, but we spend more than $20 million already on economic development, and very few of them have this kind of return, I feel.
Representative
Davis.
So you talked about this shelf-stable hummus. I'd be interested in the paragraph where you're discussing other new lines of products for schools. What sort of products are you developing?
I'm going to defer to my colleague, Rod, and to elaborate on that.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rod Friesen, Director of Sales and Marketing for Truett Family Foods. We've made a transition over the years, and we are now, as Truett Family Foods, primarily a bean company. And we do the traditional canned food service and retail beans. But the new markets that we're going to, as mentioned in Peter's testimony, is shelf-stable hummus. And trying to get low-cost protein in a great, trendy, cultural flavor that is rising into the marketplace. In addition to that, we're locally developing other healthy bean dips, white bean dips with fortified with yogurt, with creative flavors that kids enjoy, such as ranch, chili lime, all of those contributing at least one meat alternative a contribution to the food meal plan. So again, we're developing those locally and taking those regionally and nationally across the country to fill vegetarian applications on meals as well as other applications on the school lunch menu.
Thanks.
The chili, what else? The company's divided between Peter and his brother recently, but in the other side also had, was it pear crisps or cherry crisps or something anyway that was on the menu that featured a product I'm more familiar with?
Our product line that we're currently working on is meant to facilitate the use of the higher consumption rate on vegetables primarily. Mm-hmm. So that vegetables all by themselves, frankly, aren't very tasty. But when you dip it in something that is tasty, you consume more vegetables. We're trying to create a dip that contributes to the health profile as well.
And now these kids can go home and tell their parents that vegetables are not tasty, and they heard it in the legislature.
But they know better because they grow them themselves and hand them out to all their friends.
And I should mention that these dips will be available. They'll be available in single serve containers, so they're shelf stable. They don't require refrigeration, and they're just easy to transport. So.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so we are going to adjourn, or do we stay open during a field trip? Are we adjourned? Okay, all right. So I'm going to close the public hearing today, and I'm going to adjourn the House Rural Communities Committee with my thanks to all the guests who came. And we are only leaving you because we're going to go see a real live school garden. We want to come see yours, but today we have a tight timeline, so we're going about 5 minutes away to the Parish Middle School. And I think you're coming with me. That's fantastic, and those kids are going to love it.
Cool.
So let's get ourselves in the car, and we'll see people over there.
All right, so what's...
Get ourselves in the car, and we'll see people over there.
All right, so what's...